KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's second hour of Forum, we'll discuss the work of 15 women artists who have been brought together for a new exhibit presently at the San Jose Museum of Art. It's all about hybridizing humans with the digital, the electronic, and the synthetic into art. It's called Brides of Frankenstein. We'll meet the curator and a couple of the artists next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. A new experimental art exhibit running through October at the San Jose Museum of Art entitled Brides of Frankenstein includes 15 women artists, a new generation of women artists, who work with video, robotics, animation, and other original and traditional media to imbue synthetic creatures with virtual life. And in an era of robots, cyborgs, clones, mutations, and genetic engineering, we now have on display art that blends with new technology to create hybridized forms. And joining us to discuss the exhibit and its aesthetic, social, moral implications is first of all Marcia Tanner, who is curator of Brides of Frankenstein. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for inviting us.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have a couple of the artists with us. Camille Utterbach is an artist whose work is part of the show. Hi.
Hi.
And with us from Chicago is Sabrina Roff, who also is an artist exhibited in this show. And welcome, Sabrina Roff.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning to you. And glad to have you all here. Let's, Marcia and I are going to toss a little bit over here. I said the title is very clever for marquee purposes, but I don't get it. I mean, Mary Shelley admittedly was creating this whole idea of Frankenstein, and you have women creators here, so the identification with Mary Shelley. Got mm-hmm. that, right? Frankenstein, inorganic material, corpse, monster comes to life, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But brides? You want to make these artists the brides of Victor Frankenstein?
Well, they are ironically titled the Brides of Frankenstein. I think maybe Camille would probably agree with that, in the sense that they are making synthetic creatures out of, they are animating synthetic creatures out of mostly inanimate materials. But as I point out in what I wrote and in the my essay, they're also really, as artists, more like Mary Shelley. And their work, to some extent, questions the whole notion of the kind of hubris that's attached to unrestrained development of technology without any interest in the moral consequences of that. And so I think, although that makes it sound a lot more serious than it is, because it's actually a fun show.
No, they're fun. It's fun. There's humor in the show. There's aesthetic excitement in the show, and mm-hmm. all that. You would want to put a cloud over that and talk
no.
about it, right?
But the artists also are addressing very serious issues that have to do with our emotional, psychological, physical relationships with these new technologies that are mostly pretty much male-gendered and male-invented.
Not only the technologies, but also, as I was reading the material, that's the number of you, and particularly you, Marcia, put together for the show and some of the reviews and so forth, you can't help thinking about things like the Golem and Pygmalion. I mean,
absolutely.
Men animate.
Absolutely.
As opposed to women.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the other interesting thing, that traditionally it has been the male who animates a creature with life. And I was very...
But women who give birth to them.
And women who give birth to them. And supposedly that's why women didn't need to make art, because they could give birth.
Yeah, we're the guys with womb envy.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. So, I mean, in a way, to me, it was very interesting that women were taking up this trope, this sort of strategy in their art. And it made me question why they were doing it.
What are they seeing differently, though? I mean, from your perspective, you started out, I know, with 60, you whittle it down to 15, and now you've got these 15 women artists, all very different kinds of artists, but
right.
certainly part of the trope, as you say. So what is the trope from a woman's point of view that is different, perhaps?
Well, I hate to essentialize. Camille and I were talking about this before the show, and we hate to stereotype women in any way, but I was looking for work that had an emotional, psychological, physical component that really seemed to express our emotional relationships with these technologies. And I found it mostly that it was women who were doing that. They were actually, and I think perhaps because, you know, maybe it is because we're traditionally the sex that bears the children, and so much of the new technology, and particularly in, you know, genetics, genetic engineering, biotech, really challenges that traditional role, potentially. And I think that maybe that's one thing that's, that they're thinking about. I know that Camille, for instance, as an artist, is concerned about the ways in which technology can kind of disembody us and make us, put us out of our bodies. You know, we're just sitting in front of a computer all day. And so her work very much deals with embodying us in relation to technology.
Yeah, and we'll talk with Camille in a moment. We're talking now with Marcia Tanner, who's the curator of Brides of Frankenstein, currently on exhibit at the San Jose Museum of Art. But just what you said intimates and suggests the notion that many people have that technology and art are kind of antithetical to one another, that it's almost oxymoronic to bring them together in this hybridized way, but yet it works aesthetically somehow.
Well, it really does, and I think one of the interesting things about this exhibition is that many of the artists, including Camille and Sabrina, are well-known in the art and tech community and not so well-known in the mainstream museum community because people have this prejudice that you can't combine them. But in fact, all of these artists are using technology in as a medium, as if it were paint or as if it were any other kind of medium to create expressive forms and meaningful forms with some conceptual content. And the medium is really integral to what they're doing.
And what about this notion, Camille Otterbach again here with us in studio, that you know, you can't bring art and technology together in many people's minds. It's almost oxymoronic, right? Especially if you talk to the Luddites, some of the Luddites I know.
Well, I think technology is a really interesting word. It actually has a historical genesis, which, according to some reading I've been doing, is around the time of the railroads. So it basically is used to describe large systems that are hard to get our mind around. So as something that's affecting our society, it's a really interesting place to be dealing with as an artist. But I think it's important to remember, you know, the Impressionists used paint in tubes, and lead tubes were a brand new technology at that time. So the fact that they could go out and paint in the field was really radical and certainly changed what they were painting. So I think in any era, anyone who's experimenting with new forms, that's going to be seen as kind of out there and maybe not acceptable by the norm for a while. But we'll see as time goes on.
It's an interesting analogy to think of tubes. But, you know, when you think of tubes compared to some of the stuff that's in this exhibit, I mean, we're talking about Brave New World stuff, aren't we? It's almost like right out of Huxley a little bit. Let's talk about yours, in fact. I mean, because you've got an interactive large video and it's algorithmic.
Algorithmic.
I struggle with that word. And it's interactive. And, I mean, kind of give us a picture of what you've done here.
Okay, so what's important about this piece is it's responding to your body and how you move in space, so people's positions and the actual contours of their body. So I'm using a video camera as the input device. So it's looking down on the space from above, kind of like a bird's eye view. And I write computer code that looks at that video signal and it can extract these basic kinds of information out of it. And so what that allows me to do is then everything in the large projection that you see on the wall is generated based on that movement. So it's a very abstract image, but it looks, I guess the closest analogy would maybe be in some kind of abstract expressionist painting. But I come from a background in painting, so...
An abstract painting?
I did a lot of figurative work, actually, but I did figurative work where I was layering time into the image, so I would just keep painting as my models kept moving. So ironically, it's basically what I'm doing here in this installation as well, except that I'm generating it based on the rules that I write, not on my hand with a paintbrush. So it's really important to me in the image that you see that there's variation in marks and that it actually is something beautiful. But it's also important that any of the marks that are drawn have a connection to your movement. And I compose those different kinds of marks in a very conscious way so that some of them are really clear and obvious. You know, you can test, oh, hey, that's my hand moving. I see where I am. Or, you know, some get a little more complicated, like your path gets traced into the composition. And then some are much more obscure. I think I'm not sure people ever can figure out the exact rules that generate the marks, but it's clear that it's still responding to you. So thinking about composing the behaviors of my marks in response to people is sort of an extension of thinking about how you compose a painting in the first place.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned abstract painting. I think about poetry. I think about something, I don't know if you know Theodore Rithke's poem, I Know a Woman, and, you know, things are moving with you as you're moving. It's like what's outside of the self becomes reflected in the movement that's in the self, or it's all a part of kind of, well, in fact, Marcia was talking about embodiment. You say you want the feeling of embodiment, existence, and a continual flow of unique and fleeting moments. That's kind of what you're trying to capture that?
Yeah, well, exactly what you were just describing, almost this feedback loop of seeing something respond to you in real time, and you testing out, you know, what happens if I try this, what happens if I try that. I think that response of the piece, you know, starts to put you in a really interesting sort of mental and physical space where you're moving and trying things. It's a very playful kind of space. Children are really familiar with that, but I think as adults we have fewer spaces to just kind of explore kinesthetically.
This is fun. I mean, this is what kids do. It's play. It's all part of play.
There were a lot of kids in the exhibition on Sunday, and they were fascinated by Camille's piece. And they were really, you know, some of them were very deliberate and moving very slowly. Others were bouncing around, and it was just wonderful to watch them.
And what a perfect place for this to be, though. I mean, considering where you are near Silicon Valley and all, for this kind of art. The show itself is, as you said, a piece. It's a major production in itself.
Well, that's how I thought of it when I was putting it together. And thanks to the amazing Rich Carson, who is the chief of San Jose Museum's chief of exhibition design and installation, it looks fantastic. And it was also one of the best organized installations that I think any of the artists had ever worked on because of him. But it does set a kind of standard, I think, for new media installations in that Rich and I both, I mean, we agreed, we worked together for 3 months. We didn't want a series of isolated chambers or a maze-like path through the gallery. We wanted it to be open. We wanted, and that goes with Rich's general idea about installation, so that each piece has its own individual presence, but you can see the other pieces which give them context, and so it begins to seem like a composition as you move through it. And when you're in front of one piece, you feel like it has its own space and its own identity there. And then he paid a lot of attention to wall color and juxtaposition and evenly spacing the elements of the show. And anyway, it's
kind of your designer, really.
He is a designer. And so it's, I don't know how Camille feels about it, but I think it's very successful. And by the way,
it's really beautiful.
Rich has two wonderful, his team consists of Lee Dickerson and Brandon Murphy, and they're all brilliant. And it was such a joy to work with them. And he realized my dream about the show much beyond anything I could have imagined. He came up with some really wonderful, innovative ideas, like projecting the title walls. So they're projections, not printed on the wall, because during the summer the museum has a lot of weddings, and they take photographs.
Weddings of Frankenstein.
And they didn't want to have permanent signs up saying "Brides of Frankenstein." Yeah,
that would be very funny. Indeed, Marcia Tanner again is curator of Brides of Frankenstein. Think about that. Well, all right, I'm not even going to go there. But where I'd like to go actually with you is, you were inspired to some extent, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Camille and Sabrina Roth, one of the other artists in the show, by a Bill Joy article that was all about humans endangered by nanotechnology and so forth.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was actually in 2000. He wrote this rant in Wired magazine. And, of course, I mean, it was a wonderful Luddite rant, but you wouldn't expect it from Bill Joy, who was one of the founders of Sun Microsystems. And it was all about how nanotechnology and robotics and bioengineering were getting way ahead of us, and that we should really stop and think what we're doing, and you know, be more morally responsible about the consequences of all these technologies.
That's the Frankenstein story.
And that was the Frankenstein story. So I thought, yeah, there's something there.
And there it is in San Jose Museum of Art. And Sabrina Roth is also with us. She's an artist working in this exhibit, whose work is in this exhibit. She's with us from Chicago and was a curator, I guess. But also, you have a background in robotics, Sabrina?
Oh, well, not actually. I my real background is in political science, believe it or not. But I did study art and technology in grad school and took many courses in electronics. It's a rare program in Chicago that allows artists to train and learn electronics and building for robotics, but probably learn more than anything just by taking apart a lot of machines and figuring out how they all operated.
Well, there's Camille's work, drawing attention to the body. To some extent, you've got this machinery and cow gut and whatnot that has a good deal to do with dreaming about the body.
It does. It's a very meditative piece. It's a large piece, about 30 feet across by 11 feet tall. And it's a very simple theme. It's all about the pleasure of breathing. But I wanted to create a piece that would really, you know, give a more natural life reality to that theme. And I do that by programming as the piece with many breathing patterns, with this breath holding and sighing and slumbering breathing. And it's all light-based. So you see that those patterns of breathing emitted by these glowing spheres within the piece. And it has a body-like quality because it does have cow gut. And I actually made the piece. It's probably one of the most pleasurable pieces to make by mixing red ink with Mr. Bubble's bubble blowing fluid. And so I literally blew thousands of bubbles. And so inside of these spheres, I mentioned that also kind of look like petri dishes. You see all these red sort of popped bubbles, but they look more like blood cells or cells undergoing mitosis or cellular splitting. So it's very, very rich red, like very highly oxygenated blood.
What are you hoping viewers will get out of this?
Well, I hope that they get a similar sense of kind of the pleasure of, you know, the body and breathing, and also be sort of lulled into all of these meditative breathing patterns. And it's a more immersive piece, and it's a piece, you know, while it's highly, you know, industrial, I guess, in terms of the products. I mean, there's three computers that are running it. There's neon and plexi and lots of silicone. It's very natural in its embodiment of the theme. It's, the patterns themselves don't seem very computer generated or computerish at all. So I hope that they just get, you know, a pure sense of wonderment and sort of a quiet place.
And you don't see yourself as a Bride of Frankenstein, I take it.
Come on, Sabrina.
I mean, I adore the story, absolutely. But, you know, I think it's really about using the technology of our times to create these pieces that aren't, you know, sort of the next technological product that's going to be the next thing to top the landfill. You know, I think as artists you have a certain freedom. And artists using technology, you can create these beautiful sculptures and installations with technology. Not really, you know, you have that freedom to not think of it as utilitarian, although you may repurpose utilitarian technology. But instead, you create these really wonderful experiences for people.
Maybe we could have called this The Bride of Percy Bysshe Shelley, because indeed it is. That would have brought in droves of people. But no, I mean, the work of the first woman science fiction writer, really, Mary Shelley, and a great Gothic tale it is, and a lasting and enduring one. What about collecting items like this that we're talking about, Marcia Tanner? I mean, is there a market for it now?
Well, more and more museums are beginning to collect it, and I collect some. I know several people who do.
Private collectors.
Private collectors, yeah. And I mean, of course, there's always the maintenance question. And as long as the artist is alive, you can usually get things fixed.
More than just maintenance. I was reading Sabrina. You were having all kinds of anxiety about your machinery.
Well, it's always a grand experiment making this stuff. Most of us don't have degrees in engineering, but, you know, so it's always a little bit of a trial and error, but everything was running very smoothly, and I think that there's some amazing robotics in the piece, and it goes to show, you know, what you can do when you put your mind to it.
We've got a couple of international artists with us here. We should say Sabrina's shown from Dublin to Austria with this, and Camille has exhibited in Hong Kong and in Kiev in Germany, and 15 certainly different artists, but all working in electronics or living tissue and metal and inorganic material, synthetic kind of things in this Brides of Frankenstein exhibit that's currently at the San Jose Museum of Art. Tell us, Marcia, a little bit more of, I know you've got some local talents here. You've got this Gail Wright from Stanford.
Gail Wright, yes, from Stanford. And Camille just moved here from New York. And Kristen Lucas also was in New York, but she's now getting her master's in fine arts at Stanford, so she's out here too.
Give us a little description of some of the pieces, though. I know there's A Dream of Beauty, this Kristen Geisler did. I mean, pieces that people may really particularly want to hear about. Yeah.
Oh, well, I think one of the outstanding pieces that's really beautiful is Rose Breathing by Andrea Ackerman, who is...
sexy piece, yeah.
How do you know?
Well, I thought. I can judge those things.
It's sexy and menacing at the same time. It's a very large, it's a 3D computer animation that's projected on the wall, a video of a large pink rose that is breathing audibly and visibly. It's, you know, closing and opening its petals and breathing and actually moving across the screen a bit. And if you look at it carefully, you'll see that the petals look like animal tissue, like flesh. And so it's a very ambiguous image, and it's beautiful and at the same time somewhat scary and mesmerizing.
Menacing and seductive.
Yeah, menacing and seductive, just like us.
Yeah, just like women are supposed to be. I'd like maybe what you see in George O'Keefe's work. Where's the menace?
And then, well, one of the pieces that I think almost inspired the show is really rather low-tech. It's a video called Pietà by a Dutch artist, Erzsébet Bierveldt. And it's very low resolution, kind of grainy, jump with lots of erratic jump cuts. So it's a sort of disturbing looking thing. But it shows the artist in what looks like a kind of bombed out area in an East European town, with a big table on which lays, and this is the golem image, on which lays a limp clay nude figure of a woman. And she spends most of the time during the in the video trying to lift this figure up and get it to sit on its own and perhaps live on its own, and then of course it doesn't, but it's really an amazingly emotional and beautiful piece.
A lot of amazing pieces in this collection. I certainly hope that people will go down and see the exhibit. I'm going to open our phone lines and invite you to join us. You're certainly welcome to ask questions of Marcia Tanner about the exhibit, or of our two artists here, Sabrina Roff and Camille Utterback. But I'd also like to pose the question to our listeners just about how you see art and technology working together or working against each other. I mean, you've certainly not seen this exhibit, but you've got a kind of conceptual sense of it and of what the idea is behind the exhibit, of what the trope is, as we said earlier. And I'm interested to get some responses from those of you who view objects like this or have viewed objects like this and what you think about it, and particularly what you think about the idea of women creating this kind of art and being really the progenitors of this kind of art. But particularly interested in hearing from some of you in terms of how art and technology work together or don't work together for you. Are they at odds? Are they antithetical? Do they somehow come together in many pieces that you've seen? I'd like you to opine on that, if you would. And you're welcome to join us with any other questions or comments you might have. Our number here, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you, and you're cordially invited to participate in this live talk program. Again, you can join us toll-free at our toll-free number from wherever you're listening to us or however on the internet, on the Sirius satellite or on the radio. Our number is 866-733-6786. And any of you down in San Jose, particularly who have seen the exhibit, may want to comment on it. You are particularly also invited to join us. And we welcome your communication by email. If you'd like to join us that way, you can do so as well. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Join this hour by Marcia Tanner, the curator of Brides of Frankenstein, currently on exhibit at San Jose's Museum of Art, and Sabrina Roff and Camille Utterback, two of the artists who are showing in the exhibit. Welcome your calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Marcia Tanner, curator of Brides of Frankenstein, currently on exhibit at the San Jose Museum of Art, with Sabrina Roff, who's with us from Chicago, who is one of the artists of the 15 in the show, the 15 brides, if you will, and Camille Utterback here with us in studio, one of those artists as well, just moved here from Brooklyn. And I said, boy, like the other side of the moon, huh? we're also talking off air a little bit about the fact that this is a very accessible exhibit. It's also as Marcia said, a noisy one, because there's a lot of noise that goes on in
Well,
this.
I wouldn't exactly call it noise. I'd call it sound.
All right. It's a soundy exhibit.
It's a soundy exhibit, yes. I think Rich did a masterful job of trying to isolate it as much as possible, but there are some things that I really wanted to be to pervade the whole space, too, like the breathing piece, the rose breathing piece. And so there are some things that some of the videos that have a long narrative, you can actually sit comfortably under a sound dome and hear it pretty well protected from the rest of the sound. But then there are other very noisy pieces. There's a wonderful one called Are You Afraid of Dogs by the Canadian artist Tamara Stone, which is a motion-activated piece that...
You did say noisy, didn't you?
That was noisy. Oh. That one's noisy. And there's another robotic piece by Heidi Kumau that has a tantrum with its little Mary Jane feet when you pass by it.
There's all kinds of... I mean, in reading the material for this exhibit, it's hard not to run into thinking about film Matrix Trilogy and Blade
exactly.
Runner, all these things that are mentioned, Terminator and RoboCop and so forth. And you have actually a Lara Croft she puppet.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. The artist Peggy Awesh played the game for hours and hours and videotaped the game as she was playing it. And then she took that videotape and edited it as though it was found footage. And she made it into a movie, a really sort of cinematic film.
Not with Angelina Jolie, though.
No, I shouldn't say thank goodness. No, with the original.
Yes.
The original.
The computer one.
The original improbable.
Original.
The original improbable, yeah, the quote-unquote male-created improbable body of Lara Croft herself. But she turns it into kind of this existential meditation on Lara's isolation within this really strange body of hers and in this world that is totally hostile and where she only meets enemies, potential enemies, and she only has a limited range of gestures, and they're all destructive. And there's one wonderful sequence in it. It's got a beautiful soundtrack and voiceovers. And there's one wonderful sequence where Lara dies about 20 times in succession, each time in a different way, but making the same sound, which is something like, which she does about 20 times in a row. It's a really wonderful movie.
Well, can technology and art be wed, bride and groom, to each other? That's kind of one of the questions that we're grappling with here this hour, talking about this exhibit down at the San Jose Museum of Art. And I'm going to go right to your calls without tarrying. We go first to Andrew. Morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much. My question is for Camille, actually. I'm a Bay Area new media artist, and actually Camille and I have a common collaborator in Noah Ward-Fruin. And I'm a huge fan of your work, Camille, and one thing that I notice about it is how intuitive it is. And it seems to me that in many new media works, the wow factor of the technology sort of distracts the viewer, and I was wondering how you navigated that.
Well, first of all, thanks for the compliment. And I just saw Noah last week, so I'll tell him you said hi. I think that's just an aesthetic decision that is really important to me, is making work that doesn't frustrate the viewer, that doesn't put them in a position where they feel stupid or confused, which I think is unfortunately a lot of people's experience with interactive work. Part of that is just because artists are experimenting with all these different interfaces or different ways to engage with an image or representation. And, you know, it's not something that people have any experience with before, and it's not necessarily so well designed. So I do a lot of things really specifically to make it clear to people how the piece might respond to them. And some of that's just trial and error, you know, that I refine the more and more I show pieces. But with Untitled 5, which is the piece we were talking about earlier, there's this camera on the ceiling looking down, and what I do is I either paint the floor or demarcate the area on the floor where the camera's looking. And that's really important because why would someone walking into this gallery space expect a certain part of the floor, you know, to react to them? I mean, that's just illogical, you know. So how can I demarcate that and give them some kind of visual cue that the piece will respond to them when they're in that area as opposed to another area? Just from a more personal, emotional point of view, that's what got me interested in doing this kind of work, was thinking about how could I create systems that really felt fluid or felt sensual, or, you know, they were somehow interesting from a physical point of view as well as a conceptual point of view. So since that was part of my original interest, and, you know, hopefully that's still there in the work.
And Andrew, we appreciate your call. We'll go to more of your calls, and we go next to April. Morning.
Hi. I'm Michael. I'm April from San Francisco. Michael, you asked the question about technology and art, and is it you know, connected? Without it, I couldn't do my work. And I think most artists who paint or sculpt or do anything, which I do, I work with fiber and sewing machines and you know, latex paint and what have you. Without people in their labs, I couldn't do what I do.
So, well, what about bringing the two together in terms of what you exhibit or what you show or what you what you reveal as an artist?
Well, part of it is I, you know, bring together the whole idea of using technology to make these things happen. And also I have other friends who work with more like film and interactive work. Mm-hmm. They constantly do that work, and people sometimes don't take them seriously, but when they see the time and energy they put into it and the you know, the serious intellectual process that goes into the artistic output, it is a marriage. And I think State University has an art and technology section that they just put together there as a major. So there is a need, and people need to kind of wrap their brains around the idea of these two. They're going to be together no matter what we try to do to make them go away.
Well, I would agree with you there, and I thank you for the call. It's a growing area, and it's mm-hmm. an area that continues to change, as we said, as the technology changes. Women are still a minority in this, though, Marcia Tanner, aren't they?
I actually don't. They are? I mean,
well,
are they, Camille?
Are they? Yeah. Camille?
Just from my reaction to setting up this show and realizing there were all these other great, amazing women artists around me, I mean, that's pretty rare. I think I don't have any actual statistical data on that, but I think it's certainly changing really quickly because there are so many wonderful programs like what Sabrina was talking about, mm-hmm. Where artists are really encouraged to learn about the technology. So you don't necessarily have to go through a computer science program to get some background in programming, to get some background in electronics. So I think that's changing things because there's not a particular kind of barrier towards getting into, you know, the really heart of this material. But I do think it probably still is pretty imbalanced.
Well, Sabrina, how did you go from being a curator and being a political science major to this world?
Oh, yeah, it was a, well, kind of roundabout process, but I actually began curating while studying political science in Washington, D.C., and just through meeting all these artists that I admired, I realized that that was really what I wanted to do with my own life. But I studied at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where they have one of the older art and technology programs, and they are becoming more and more common. And I think to address the question of, you know, how many women are involved, I mean, in general, if you look at art schools today, the majority of students are women, and these programs are very popular, and in my case, the majority of the grad students in the program were also women. So I think you will see much more of a changeover right now. I mean, I find no lack of incredibly talented women artists working in the field, and I think that learning the technology in an art school is incredibly important. I mean, artists have always been sort of a humanizing factor in society, and most artists are fairly conscientious people, and they want it to speak to the times that they live in and speak to that through their art.
But does art, here's sort of that key question again, does art that has to do with the synthetic and the inhuman and the inorganic, how does it humanize us?
Well, because it's not necessarily about the synthetic or the inhuman. I mean, if you take, for example, Camille's piece, it's a generative artwork. It's an artwork that responds to people and changes and creates art, you know, in flux all the time. And it's a fascinating process. And it doesn't, you know, you don't get that sense of, you know, sort of cold material at all. It's responsive. And we live in an era of bioengineering and genetic engineering and, you know, stem cell research, and it's all these sort of scary frontiers that are also really exciting. And artists can comment on those things, you know, by you know, making manifestos or drawing, you know, or making paintings. But if you actually get to use the same materials as the scientists use and use those to comment on, you know, either the ethics or possible alternative veins of research, right, that's a highly valuable thing. And we're not, as I mentioned earlier, dependent on, you know, money from industry or money from particular research grants.
Let me go back to the spirit of Mary Shelley, though. I mean, you know, she was, Frankenstein can be read as a very profound critique of science and of progress.
Well, it's a certain kind of critique of science. I think she was really very much questioning I think she was interested in science as a way of investigating the mysteries of nature, understanding nature, and I think what she questioned was the notion that of the ways it can be manipulated once you understand it.
Is what a lot of people feel about cloning and biotechnology.
Absolutely.
And genetically
yeah.
modified
right.
plants and animals.
And these all hit us, you know, right where we live, literally.
And even some of the sort of less biological kinds of technology, like the video tracking I use. I mean, that certainly has the potential and is being used in very sort of scary ways.
For surveillance, you know, yeah.
Especially when we have things now like the Patriot Act, you know, where this kind of information can be used in all different ways that perhaps it wasn't, you know, possible or legal to do before.
So there's the ambiguity again that Marcia was speaking about before, which of course great art always has to mm-hmm. some extent. I mean, mm-hmm. what you're saying about the rose, you know, you have all this new technology and it brings with it all kinds of great things at the same time that they're menacing things.
Mm-hmm. But I like to hope that by showing another possibility for that same technology, my work and the other works in the show make people realize there's a choice about how we use this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily, you know, often the technology directs a bit how we might use it. It suggests a particular use, probably based on, you know, the money that was put into it when it was being developed. But you can certainly take that same technology and use it for something very different.
Exactly.
And all the more important to do that. So that.
Oh, careful, Camille. I remember that San Jose Mercury News said social commentary above art. Is that what we're hearing here? Social commentary more than the art?
They go hand in hand. I mean, all
they're
of the
wedded
work,
to each other.
All,
too,
well, huh? Exactly. All the work in the show has a conceptual basis. Otherwise, it wouldn't be very interesting.
Let me go to more of your calls here, and we go next to Santa Cruz. Jesse, morning.
Yeah, actually, that fits perfectly with what I was going to ask. I just read an article by Alfred Gell titled "Technology: The British Social Anthropologist Alfred Gell," titled "Technology and." The technology of enchantment and the enchantment of technology, and I was wondering if you could. And he argues in this essay that that art and technology, in fact, is neither sort of a concrete creation nor a tangible object, but is actually a process that mediates social relationships. And I was wondering if you could talk about what social nexuses, what relationships this art and this art exhibit speaks to. And I'll take my question off there.
All right. Thank you, Jesse, for the call. Marcia Tanner?
Oh, what social nexuses? Well, I think, first of all, it obviously has to do with human relationships at the most fundamental level, because there is always this worry that we're going to be interacting with machines and more and more with each other. And I think one of the things that this show does is just the opposite of that. I think it really engages people not only with the work, but reminds them that they are in themselves and in their bodies, and they're also motivated to talk to each other about the work. And that's part of the purpose of the exhibition, is to open up more dialogue and questions about the kind of issues that are being discussed. Then let's see, social nexuses. Well, Camille pointed out the whole political component of, you know, the possible misuses of some of these technologies and the ways those are being redressed by a lot of the artists in this show and offering up alternative possibilities for imagining how to use these technologies in relation to us to enhance our lives, for creative rather than destructive purposes. And that's one of the main motivations of this show. I wanted to inspire people to realize that there were creative ways to use this stuff. And let's see, I don't know, do you have something you want to say, Camille?
I was just thinking about humor in all of this, which actually does relate to the social nexus, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, we've been talking on this very serious level about the work, but it's a very funny show, too. I mean, even in the name, we were laughing about it at the beginning of the show. But I think that humor is a way that many of the artists are pointing out mm-hmm. some of the important issues. And so by reframing it in a sort of funny way, like two of my other pieces that are in the show, Balance and Shaken, are these reactive objects. So balance is a sort of precarious structure with a screen on the top that, as you unbalance the object, there's a video of a woman on the screen that falls, you know, so she can be sort of halfway falling or all the way falling based on how much you've tilted the object. And for me, that piece was really about, you know, our struggle with all these interfaces around us all the time, and how, you know, we're constantly at the beck and call of our cell phones now, and, you know, the ATM machine tries to have a conversation with you, and, you know, we just get embedded in these different kinds of interfaces. And I kind of wanted to turn that around to something that felt really light and fun, and again, maybe pointed out that the same kind of engagement with the machine could have a really different feel.
Well, I don't know if it was in conjunction with the fact that I'm doing an hour on the show, but someone sent me from the internet a picture and said the power of money, and there was a man who was old, decrepit, and grotesque, and he was obviously a bridegroom with this lovely, young, nubile, princess-looking bride.
This is a stretch, Michael. I can see this.
No, I mean, you want, I'll show you the photograph.
No, go on.
No, but it said the power of money. And I was looking at it, and of course, I thought Bride of Frankenstein. That was my immediate thought, because this is a creature and an ugly person with a very young and beautiful person.
Well, actually, I don't know how we got back to Mary Shelley, but, you know.
I was just talking about the fun and the amusing side of it. I mean,
yeah,
when
absolutely.
I looked at that, I was very amused with it because it was a way of saying.
Related to this, yeah.
This title again. But let me go to more calls.
Well, here. I was going to say, first of all, that the work that Sabrina Raff has in the show, her photographs are very funny. And, she'll have a chance to talk about them at some point.
Well, we'll go to Sabrina in a moment. Let me go to Ace first, though, who's been waiting patiently to join our conversation. Hi, Ace.
Hello. I just wanted to comment on how appropriate this seems. You always have the age-old conflict, it seems, the yin and yang between the emotional and the technical, men and women, artistic and technical. I actually came from a technical background, burned out on that, and now I'm more or less an artist, so I think it's entirely...
Well, which is it, more or less?
More or less. Well, I started off training as an electrical design engineer and ended up kind of more or less a starving artist now. So I kind of really have a good feel for what's going on here. It's kind of a work of art in itself. Putting women to the forefront it's cool. It's progressive. And at the same time, it reminds us of the age-old tacit conflicts of interest. So between art and technology, they always seem to be at odds, but at the same time, without one or the other, they wouldn't exist. So it seems like my questions were pretty well covered by the other callers, but what I'd like to do is have perhaps the guests speculate on the future of artistic media and maybe speculate on how these will blend between art and technology. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Get out your periscope. What do you see around the corner here for this kind of work? Camille?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think there's been a lot of shifting in work towards these larger systems, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, network-based art is just one example, but there have been a lot of projects like Rafael Lozano Hammer where, you know, there's these spotlights over Mexico City that people all over the world are controlling. I mean, that was also network-based, but there are... you know, Natalie Jeremchenko's One Tree project, which is like one tree that she clones and has planted all over the world, you know, and is monitoring how it's doing. And I think part of that shift in form of the work is, again, based on some of the social issues we're grappling with. So that's just one direction I might see.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of networking art that's done with cell phones and that sort of thing, where whole groups of people who are not artists are, you know, sort of working on a collaborative artistic project. I'm trying to think of some others. But
there's been some interesting games. I forget the name. There was a group of artists in New York City where you take your PDA or your phone, I think, and it was kind of like a treasure hunt over the whole city with lots of people. I should mention, since we're talking about that, in San Jose in 2006, the ISEA conference will take place, which is an international conference of new media art or art and technology. And I know a lot of their themes are about these kind of distributed ideas or, you know, how does technology change
our
ideas
that comes,
of cities?
We'll do something on it probably on forum. Sabrina Raff, let's hear from you. And what about the humor in your photographs?
Oh, well, I think that, you know, another area, let me just comment briefly on the previous discussion, was that a lot of artists are actually using real life forms in their art. An artist, Ken Rinaldo, uses fish to actually drive his sculptures around the space. And in my newest photography, it's a series called Secrete, but it's actually just kind of ruminations on the future. And if we could genetically engineer organisms to live with us and sort of symbiotically, what would they be so that, you know, in essence, eventually we could live, you know, in a very sustainable manner on the Earth as we use up all our resources. So there's a particularly funny one I think that Marsha would probably want me to talk about, called Pigment Eaters. And for this series of photographs, it's sort of a short performance, actually. I made up these little bugs that I called pigment eaters. They're actually not that little. And they're designed upon a mayfly, and they fly around us and live in our environment, and they actually suck the pigment out of our hair as their food, and then we gently milk them, and then writers use that as their writing ink. So it's just these sort of strange little creatures that, you know, as long as we have the power to genetically engineer new life forms, you know, what can we come up with that can actually improve our environment or live with us?
It makes me think, actually, of Rilke. My devils are my angels. Here's a couple of emails. This is from Herbert. Says, the Exploratorium is a place of such merger worth mentioning. It seems immaterial whether male or female creates such art. Aside from that, art has always used whatever technology is at hand. The method should cater to the art being produced, so to speak, aid the intelligence. At any rate, the medium shouldn't be the message. The medium should at most augment the message.
Well, I totally agree with that.
And here's another listener named Catherine who says, hi, Marsha. The show is brilliant. Was pleased to see it on Sunday. You'd mentioned the possible book to be developed. Do you think this will be an edited volume? And can you speak a bit about the afterlife of the bride?
Oh, my gosh. What a softball question. Well, there's a possibility that it might travel, and I'm going to start investigating that soon. But at this moment, it is not, and that's one thing I would like to do. And another thing I'd like to do is write a real book on this subject that really goes more deeply into drawing more artists into the fold and tracing the history and background of the kinds of work that I've been looking at. And
Robin just informs me you're giving a talk on this on August 10th at the museum.
Tomorrow I'm giving. Thank you, Robin. I'm giving a short talk at lunchtime talk at I think noon. And then there are some other programs that are coming up that should be really wonderful among the artists, which I'll be moderating. There was just one on Sunday, last Sunday. Andrea Ackerman, who's one of the artists, will be speaking with Ellen Ullman. I think you know who she is, our author of The Bug and Close to the Machine. And that will be on Friday, September 23rd, at 8 p.m. at the museum. And then Camille will be speaking with Anne Mallore, who is the author, who's Mary Shelley scholar, and who wrote a book called Mary Shelley, Her Life, Her Fiction, Her Monsters, and that will be on Saturday, October 15th, 2005, at 2 p.m.
How much do the, quote, serious art critics, establishment art critics, how much do they take this kind of art seriously, in your judgment? More traditional art,
I don't know if they don't take it seriously. I think they may not necessarily know how to approach it.
I think there's a real problem in terms of lack of interesting art criticism about this work. Mm. So
Marsha has to do the book.
Yeah, one of the shows I had at Chelsea Marlborough got reviewed in Art in America, and I was so excited. And then when I read the review, you know, I was hoping there would be some insight for me about my work, but it was just an absolute description of the system. And there was no discussion about the aesthetics in the projection, which this was a painting show that I was in. Right, so all the discussion about the other works was about the line and the marks and, you know, how that worked together. So I think it sometimes just throws people off that there's so many aspects that one could talk about. I think we might really look for some interesting criticism, maybe more out of the performance art community. Mm. Because a lot of this work, I mean, actually not all the works in the show, but the kind of work I'm doing is always very time-based and very performative in that people are in movement. It's live, if you will. So I think there's a way where, you know, maybe it's a different tradition needs to step up to the plate to talk about some of this.
Let me have more of our callers step up here in the time remaining. Stephen, morning.
Yes, good morning. Want to talk about you talk about art and science. Well, add to that play. They're all really ways we explore both the, you know, all the aspects of the world we live in. And maybe art should be considered a mature form of play. The question was, how does it become humanized? It becomes humanized by the very time your hand touches it. And go ahead and call it noise. Call it a joyful noise. And that's it for me, and I'll take the rest off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. course, mostly when you go in art museums, you're not supposed to touch. But when you're talking about interactive, you're opening up a whole new world.
Yes, well, there are several interactive pieces in the show, and some of them you don't touch. You just wave your hand or something, or walk in front of them, or speak into a microphone. But Camille's potent objects definitely must be touched. They need to be. The other one is called Shaken. She described balance, where you balance the weights on the arms. But Shaken is actually like a snow globe, which also has a little video of a woman. In this case, it's actually Camille. And when you shake it, she gets very agitated. And the more you shake it, the more agitated she becomes. And it's really a wonderful little piece. And so we've given very explicit instructions on those pieces that need to be interacted with. People are invited to interact, and then they're told how to do it. And we hope that they will do it that way, not some other way.
Well, it's going to be through October. The Brides of Frankenstein, currently on exhibit at the San Jose Museum of Art. And those of you, not only in San Jose and down in the South Bay, but throughout the Bay Area, may indeed want to avail yourself of this exhibit, which has been put together by Marcia Turner. Marcia Tanner, excuse me. I was going to mention Rich Carson, too.
Oh, yes,
you mentioned
please.
Earlier. And we thank you, Marcia, again, the curator of The Brides of Frankenstein. Also thank the two artists who were with us this morning, Sabrina Roth and Camille Utterbach. And thanks to you, our listeners, who we appreciate greatly. And thanks to those of you who called in this hour and emailed us. Appreciate that very much as well. Want to extend thanks also to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, been working last few weeks also with Mark Brindell, whom we have a debt of gratitude to express to as well. And our engineer is Paul Ancour. Back with you tomorrow. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling response number, which is 415-553-3300. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we're also on the Internet and on the Sirius satellite. Our thanks also to our executive producer, Raul Ramirez, and for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.